Welcome to this series of Grant Thornton's Pensions Advisory Podcasts. In this edition, we'll be looking specifically at scheme funding and some of the key issues and challenges facing pension scheme trustees, their employers and other stakeholders. To make sense of these issues, I'm joined by my colleagues from the Pensions Advisory Team, Phil Green and Jamie McKenzie, both of whom are very experienced pension specialists who work for many years on a large number of employer covenant assignments. My first question then, Phil, is a very simple one. Why do schemes need ongoing funding advice?
Well, it's important that pension schemes understand the risks that they're being faced. And those risks tend to fall within three categories, I guess. You've got a risk of something happening to the covenant. There's a funding risk, as in how are you going to get the money into the scheme, and the investment risk as to what's going to happen with the scheme assets.
Sure.
The regulator, the regulator's recently brought out some guidance, integrated risk fund managing. And the key there is to try and take a holistic approach of all of these. So look at everything in an overview. And that's quite important because if you think about it, if you've got a weak covenant, you're saying your employer can't really afford to pay much into the scheme or afford to meet any movements in the investment returns, it's important to make sure that the investment risk and the funding risk are lined up. You don't want an overly aggressive investment policy, which means that you're going to be requiring significantly additional funds and money coming through from the employer in future times if he can't afford it. So that's one of the circumstances where it's important to understand the risks. You've also got to look at what the covenant is supposed to do. The covenant is supposed to be providing trustees with an understanding of what the ability of their employer is. And that's not just a one-off issue. That's got to be looked at on a regular basis, not just from a monitoring point of view, but equally when transactions occur.
Yeah.
And it's important to understand where you are before the transaction occurs so that you can understand the level of detriment that might be arising from that transaction.
Okay. So back to basics question, Jamie, then. What's involved in the covenant assessment, particularly at the triennial valuation time?
Covenant assessments vary from scheme to scheme and employer group to employer group, but it's really a case of horses for courses. So, but the common considerations that we see are who's legally liable, so establishing which employers actually support the scheme, so which ones are legally obliged, because quite often FDs will present to trustee bodies and they'll present on a group basis or a consolidated basis, but it's important for the trustees to determine exactly which employers support them and which one, and focus on them for their reviews. Another thing to think about is where are these businesses going? So how are their markets working? Are they, you know, is it developing? Think about where they're going in the future and trends in relation to that. And then also covenant assessment should be forward looking, thinking about the financial ability now, but in the future as well. And we'd base that view on the future on the historics as well. So we'd think about how has it performed historically? What have volumes and profitabilities looked like in the past? And then thinking about how achievable budgets have been. Have they always been achieving budgets? Are they strong in performance that way? Another thing you might think about is the capability of the balance sheet to support the covenant if needed. So actually support the scheme, because usually the scheme is an unsecured creditor. So it's important to understand any other security that's in the place. So where does the scheme rank as a creditor and its priority? Other creditors, typically the banks, might have secured debt. So you need to understand how the funds might flow in the event of an insolvency and what would come through to the scheme. One of the main focuses in a covenant assessment, though, is focus on the cash flows rather than just the profit. It's a better measure of the ability of the employer to make contributions to the scheme.
Now, I assume the pensions regulator gets involved at these kind of times. Do they allow trustees to do this kind of covenant review work themselves? Phil?
Well, they do, provided the requirement of the regulator is that an independent view is formed. If the trustees believe themselves to be sufficiently independent that they can do it themselves, then there's no reason why they have to go out to a third party. You often look, if you look at trustee boards, there's often an awful lot of experience on trustee boards and past knowledge about how the business itself is run. And it's often ridiculous almost to ignore that. So any covenant assessor, even if they're third party, would tap into that knowledge from the trustees already have. So any review has to be independent, doesn't have to be third party. But the trustees have got to expect that if they do it themselves, they will be robustly challenged by the regulator, because he's very keen to make sure that there are no conflict issues arising. Past relationships are coming into play between the trustees and members and sort of previous management. So anything which is not done, any covenant review that's not undertaken by a third party, is likely to get a bit more of a robust review from the regulator than one which is...
And it's presumably good. It's just good governance to do it independently, Jamie.
Yeah, it's good governance to get an independent view. Independent covenant assessors have the benefit of doing this professionally and a considerable experience of looking at all the different situations, so that's a lot that can be brought to the table and add value to covenant.
Now, I'm aware that the regulator and the PPF, the TPR and the PPF have both... on a regular basis do distribute information for these kinds of assignments. What have in the last year, there's been an awful lot that comes out of both the regulator and the PPF. What are the sort of things they've been saying?
Well, in the last year, we've seen a flurry of stuff come out from the pensions regulator. In 2014, there was the updated code of practice on funding defined benefit schemes. 2015, we had not only the covenant guidance, but also the integrated risk management guidance, which came out in December of last year. As mentioned earlier, that's trying to bring this more holistic approach together as to how you review the covenant funding and investment risks. So there has been a lot of guidance out there. The PPF on a regular basis puts out guidance in respect to the PPF guarantee recertification process. Yeah. And it's only going to continue. We're going to see more bits from them in this year as well, I imagine.
Key issues to keep in mind, Jamie?
Just thinking about the regulatory objective, which came into force in July 14, to minimise any adverse impact on the sustainable growth of an employer. It's important for trustees and employers to think about how they're investing in growth and the cash flows that they're generating. So if an employer plans to invest in sustainable growth, and this restricts funds that are available to the scheme, the scheme need to understand how it will benefit from this investment. You know, trustees shouldn't accept lower deficit repair contributions to support investment in sustainable growth, which sits outside their employer group, if they're not going to benefit from it. But you know, that it could be the case that the company provides a guarantee to give mitigation for that investment.
Right.
And then thinking about code of practice, that kind of picks up on what Phil was talking about earlier about it being an integrated, holistic approach to scheme funding and risk management. So it's understanding that covenant underpins the trustee's approach to investment risk, so the level of risk they're targeting, funding is like the prudence and the actuarial assumptions and the recovery plan. The code of practice was really a refresh of the previous code of practice.
Yeah.
But it was written in hindsight of what happened in the economy, so taking account of the credit crunch and thinking about how that impacts on employers and schemes.
So Phil, what about the other recent guidance that's come out?
Well, the integrated risk management guidance, which came out in December last year, I think we've already touched upon with the regulator's enforcement of this holistic approach they want you to take or want trustees to take when considering the three main types of funding, types of risk which are facing pension schemes: covenant, funding and investment risk. There was also some covenant guidance that came out last year, in which the regulator sort of recognised the fact that the people who were doing the 2015 cohort was a bit of an unlucky cohort.
Yes.
Because it was the actual nature of what the investments were doing at that time, and deficits were getting greater. And therefore that really did imply that one of the things that trustees need to think about is affordability and how, whether or not deficit repair contributions are affordable by employers, and if they're not, it sort of opened the way slightly for a review of actually reducing deficit repair contributions in the short term going forward, which is a bit of a step forward for the regulator. However, they also introduced an idea of maybe more contingent asset security being put in place and some asset-backed funding arrangements, which are something else which have been prevalent in the market these days, being put in place to provide the additional support which is being lost by the lower deficit repair contributions.
Does any of this have an effect on PPF certification, for example?
Well, Jamie's certainly been doing a few of those, and I'm sure he can make a few comments on that.
Yeah, as Phil was saying, the guidance changes on that frequently. And the most recent that's come out is guidance in relation to certifying for the 15-16 levy year. And what changed there was that trustees need to certify a specific amount that they can recover from the guarantor on insolvency. And it's called a realisable recovery. So we've reviewed a material number of guarantee certifications, and it's not quite as simple as saying, okay, there's a 50 million guarantee and the guarantor has 100 million sitting on its balance sheet, so therefore it can cover the guarantee. It's a case of saying, well, what is that 100 million on their balance sheet there for? they don't normally just have it sitting there. It's usually used for working capital, acquisition finance. It might even be connected to their covenants in relation to the amount of debt and cash they hold. So it's a case of thinking about how that would flow through. So I guess it's not just thinking about it theoretically, it's thinking about practically how could you demonstrate that the guarantor could pay that amount. So, and I guess what we'd probably put in connection is that is the larger the guarantee put for by the employer, the more work you'd expect to be put in to demonstrate that it does cover that.
Right. So finally, Phil, you mentioned a few of the newer instruments like use of contingent assets and asset-backed sort of vehicles, that sort of thing. What is around? How do those work?
Well, there's been a number of the asset-backed funding arrangements being put in place recently for covering everything from cheese to whiskey to property. It's quite bizarre, but that they are out there. You know, property, intellectual property debtors are the more common ones, where you get an income stream coming off these assets, which is effectively pledged to the pension scheme, in lieu of a deficit repair payment, or as a backup, or a in addition to an agreed deficit repair contribution schedule. And in that way, companies are able to ring fence assets and get the trustees a little bit more comfortable with what the level of payments are going to be over a period of time. The issue always with them is for trustees to really understand what they're signing up to when they agree to them. What are their step-in rights if it all goes wrong? So if, for example, the employer has to go through some form of insolvency process, does the asset become an asset of the pension scheme? Is it something that they can then sell and get money in from? Or are they really just securitising a future income stream with no proprietary rights over the underlying assets?
Right.
Contingent assets are a little bit more common. Guarantees are probably one of the easiest ways of thinking about contingent assets. Once again, your issue there is it's a nice to have, but you've got to understand what actually it is you've got.
Yeah.
And if you're going to be in a recovery scenario, can the guarantor afford to pay the guarantee? This comes back to the recertification of the PPF guarantees that Jamie was talking about. It's all well and good to do a theoretical exercise and say, it looks as though there's some money there, but in a recovery scenario, what's going to happen to that guarantor? Will he really be able to make a payment under that guarantee? So it's really down to the detail of all of these things. They are good, they provide additional security to the trustees, and they often provide a seat at a table in a future restructuring. No, we'll touch on restructurings probably under a different podcast, but they are important for those reasons as well. So, you know, if trustees can get them, by all means, it's something they should be thinking about negotiating.
Gentlemen, thank you for your time, and thanks for joining us. As usual, you can find all the information on this very complex subject, including a transcript of this podcast, at our website at grantthornton.co.uk/pensionsadvisory.